Okay. So I feel that the organizers made a very good job to bring together so many people. I have to thank them, especially thank to invite me as well. And also I have to thank all the sponsoring institutions who made possible this meeting. The organizers made a very good job as well to place me soon after Ernie's talk because of he mentioned the Bloch-Sommerer-Rigaud theorem several times. But unfortunately, I am not going to speak about this. Basically because I cannot say anything new to you, especially not as spectacular new as Ernie told. I was in a rather hard situation to find a perfect subject for a meeting entitled Additive Combinatorics, Number Theory and Harmonic Analysis, if I want to find something in the intersection of the three things, so which has connection to all of them. And unfortunately, I had to go back a little in time to find something, which means that some of you already knew everything what I am going to speak. But there are so many young mathematicians among us, maybe there will be a few that it is new. It is new. So what I am going to speak about is this is one of my favorite subjects in the last decade, and it is still not finished, so this is why I want to warm it up. Consider the trigonometric sum, actually introduced by Terry Tao today morning, so the organizers made a good job selecting the talk together. And the question is to estimate the L1 mean of that from below. So harmonic analysis is here. If you don't remember the definition from Terry's talk, e to y is e to the 2 pi I y. But I have to say harmonic is here, analysis is here. Number theory is certainly here. Mu of n is defined as minus 1. This is also defined by Terry. Minus 1 to the r for a square free number, which is the product of r primes. And 0 otherwise. So n is not square free. And the connection to the additive combinatorics, well, this is the hardest part to me, but luckily enough, Terry already discussed that part. This problem has, I have very good memory with this problem. Anytime I spoke about it, there were always somebody in the audience who come up with brilliant ideas how to improve, giving me the possibility to talk about it again later on. Actually, this time, nobody of those guys in the audience, so this job should be done with someone else. Okay. I am going to use a little bit unusual strategy because describing the history I'm going counterclockwise or backward in time. So I start with the newest result and go back and back to older and weaker results. But there will be a reason what I will explain at the end. So let's start with the last approach or latest approach. Of course, I will also use the strategy that if something is simple, I will explain in detail. If something is complicated, I will just jump on it. So this dates back. This is in a paper with Rujat, so you can guess he's one of who gave the brilliant ideas. And the paper appeared in 2001, so pretty old now. And this approach is based on the simple notion of convolution. If you don't remember what convolution in Fourier series or trigonometric sums is, I quickly remind you. So if you have two trigonometric sums, you can always think about as finite sums, so no, that is a finite sum and it is a finite sum, whatever I study today. So I don't write limits, but these are finite sums. Then it is a simple method to compute what is the integral f of alpha minus beta g of beta d beta. Well, what you have to do is put the sums in. You get an bm and then e to the n alpha e to the e to the n alpha minus beta. I write a little bit bigger. So e to the n alpha minus beta e to the n beta. And don't forget the integral. And you can, using the multiplicative property of the exponential function, you can just rearrange a little and see that you can separate everything with which connected to beta. So you get e n alpha from here, and then the integral of e n minus m beta d beta. And thanks to the orthogonality of the trigonometric polynomials, the integral is practically zero unless n equals m. So what is only left is sum of a n b n, so m should be n, e n alpha. In other words, the convolution of the two is the convolution of those two function is the one with coefficients is just the product of them. So if we denote our interested polynomial as mu m of alpha, so this is mu n e n alpha up to x, and we apply, or better to say, we compute the convolution of m with itself, then according to that we get, I leave a little room, we get the following trigonometric function. And if the two functions agree, then as well the L1 norm agree. Here we use a simple triangle inequality, getting that this is certainly not bigger than taking the absolute value inside. And of course, you can recognize that this is nothing else, fix beta and integrate alpha first, and then beta is, it is nothing else than the square of the L1 mean. In other words, getting a lower bound for this L1 mean, it's enough to have a lower bound for that L1 mean. What did we gain? Well, it looks like a simpler object. This is just 0 and 1. Depending on n is square phi or not, and that's a very very simple arithmetic function. I will indicate several good properties there. So, the first approach is basically finished because it was proved by, I am not using the computer science language, so I write the names all together, and this is a long list. So it was proved by that L1 min was investigated by Brüdern, Andrew, Granville, Alberto Perelli, Bob Vaughan, and Trevor. Well, the dates are a little bit misleading because some journals appear very slowly, some very quickly, so these are about the same time, actually, or close to the same time. They proved that this L1 mean we get too interested in now is bounded by from above by x to 1/3 plus epsilon and from below by x to 1/4. Actually, they worked with R-free integers. So there is a general result where here the exponent is 1 over R plus 1 and here the exponent is 1 over 2R. So if you combine this lower bound with that, then we can get, I don't claim as a theorem, we can get a lower bound for the L1 mean in the form square root of that, so x to the 1 over 8. The L1 mean is always smaller than the L2 mean, so the square root of what you get from Parseval identity, which is actually a special case here, just take alpha equals 0 and g is the compact conjugate of f minus beta, and then you get sum of the coefficient square. So, and we all know that so the sum of the coefficient squared is just the number of square free numbers, and that's about constant times x, so the square root of it is square root x up and x to 1 over 8 from below. The good point is that we could gain, actually the big part of the job was done by them. You could gain a power of x as a lower bound. You can think about it a little bit as Littlewood conjecture, which guarantees for a very general trigonometric sum with coefficients. So you get log the number of non-zero coefficients as far as those are at least one in absolute value. And compared to that, we got a power of x. Of course, it's just the beginning, or better to say, the end of some story. In that paper, they listed plenty of consequences of the theorem, and I mentioned a few of them. Actually, they are all consequences of the upper bound, and for us, we were needed the lower bound, but it is still interesting to mention, and especially I want to mention because they connect to additive number theory again. So from this upper bound, one can derive results of the form. Where are they listed? Ah, here. See, we can get an asymptotic for the number of representation as n as a sum of square free or more general R-free numbers, or even more general, they can, so AJ can be different free, RJ free. It's not so surprising to get a result like that, but actually they get it using the circle method, which is again not so surprising, but it even works for k equals 2. It's the very few examples when the circle method gives something for k equals 2, so for a binary problem. And although with square free numbers, for example, it was long known even from elementary number theory, so there is elementary calculation to giving the result, and even the elementary calculation gives something stronger error term, but again, circle method works for k equals 2, which is something a real rarity. Another consequence that one can reflect what we know about the set of sums of three cubes. It is still not known that almost every number is a sum of three cubes. What is known is that something like up to x, at least x2, well, 11 over 12 is a good exponent, but there is some slightly bigger exponent, but I cannot recall now, and it's certainly not such a nice number. But that's a relatively easy result of Trevor, that x to 11 over 12 and a little bit better is an lower bound for the number of integers, which is sum of three cubes. And with this thing, you can reflect it, you can translate it to square free numbers. So even among the square free numbers, so the number of representation of square free numbers, the number of square free numbers, so the number of square free n in the form sum of three cubes is also at least n to the up to n n to 11 over 12. Okay, so this paper is really a beautiful paper, but it has two things which annoyed me. One of them that they don't mention this application, although I believe that they were aware of at least the problem, because they mention it immediately in the introduction. The other one, that they also made the assumption that just like in many of the number theoretic problems, when you have an upper bound and a lower bound, and somehow, well, if I go into details, but I'm not, to the proofs, it turns out that the upper bound is rather straightforward, while the lower bound is rather delicate to get. Just think about the Dirichlet divisor problem, where the first upper bound, something like x to 1 half, is almost trivial. The lower bound, x to 1 quarter, is a little bit more delicate, and then the 1 half is improved to 1 third with elementary methods, and then even slower, even below with more and more sophisticated methods, and still the lower bound is not matched with the upper bound. So they express their opinion that probably here as well, the lower bound reflects the right order of magnitude. But this was not the case. And this is actually the paper I referred somewhere, it's 2001, that we improved the lower bound to 1/3 with Ruzsa, and we also improved the upper bound to 1/3. So go to the right order of the L1 mean of this simpler. Trigonometric sum. The The upper bound is rather similar to the. This is rather straightforward, and everything is based on the representation of mu. So the indicator function of square field numbers can be expressed like an inclusion-exclusion argument. So for every square divisor of n, some mu d. And if you put this there, change the order of summation, you get something, especially you get the Dirichlet kernel, and I am going to use it later, so I introduce a notation for it. All coefficients is 1. And the properties of the Dirichlet kernel is well known, so if you put it in, then you can compute up and down. You have to split according to the size of D and get it. So to improve the upper bound, nothing else was needed, just to make this split smooth. And that saved the epsilon, but this, of course, not a big change. For the lower bound, even for the lower bound, it was not that different. For the lower bound, absolute value is positive, so you can just select a part of the integral where it should be big, and a more delicate selection give a better bound. Okay, I guess it is time to step back for the next approach, which is my favorite. So this is the last but one approach. Which goes not much back, 99, and still Ruja and myself. And this is based basically not just convolution, but approximation and convolution. So the Dirichlet kernel is defined, and the problem is to find a good approximation for the Dirichlet kernel in the following sense. So find F alpha, which is a trigonometric polynomial again, and we require that C n is 0 for square free. For square free n, and it approximates the Dirichlet kernel, so f of alpha minus d of alpha in absolute value is small. And actually what we could prove, that you can find as big as x to the 3/4 log square x. Okay. So what is the use of the approximation? Well, it is now similar to what we did with convolution. If you compute this convolution, say, start with the, oh, it was good. So I start with the Dirichlet kernel first, d alpha minus beta m beta. Then this is a convolution, and what we get is the trigonometric polynomial where the coefficients are the product. But this is product of these coefficients, but here every coefficient is 1, so we just get back m of alpha. On the other hand, with f of alpha, m beta d beta, this, you just get 0, because the condition says that when you take the product of the coefficients, the appropriate coefficients, either of them is always 0. So subtract them, and you get that m of alpha is actually the same than d alpha minus f of alpha times alpha minus beta. Probably the shortest way is to write in this way. M beta d beta. But this is small, as we saw. So m of alpha is bounded from above by x to the 3/4 log square x times the L1 mean of m beta d beta. So what does it mean? If the L1 mean is small, then m is actually uniformly small. I didn't emphasize that, of course, the bound is uniform in alpha, so there is no alpha dependence on the constant. So if the L1 mean is small, then it is uniformly small, but if it is uniformly small, then the L1 mean big, because of the L2 mean is big. That's the very, very, very simple estimate that the L1 mean can be maybe it's better to write beta here can be bounded from below by the L2 mean divided by the maximum. So if you just put the maximum, this maximum inside, and also remember that the Parseval identity, this is constant times x, put that back in, we get x to the 3/4 log square x times the square of the L1 mean. And comparing the sides, I wanted to note something. Yes, this one. Comparing the sides, taking the square root, you get a lower bound in the form x to 1 over 8. Divided by a log from here. So it's already a power of x, what we generally like. And not like in the first approach, where thanks to the fact that you cannot improve the lower bound there, so the first approach gives 1 over 6 and nothing else. Here there is maybe some room for improvement. You just have to construct a better approximation. Maybe x to 1/2, say. If it is x to 1/2, then plugging that here and here, you get x to 1/4 there, and that's something we would be happy to see. But unfortunately, that is not true. You cannot approximate as good as x to 1/2. And this actually follows from here and there, because realize we haven't used too much about the Möbius function. Everything, m was just an arbitrary function here, an arbitrary trigonometric polynomial with length x. So just use it for mu square instead of mu, and plug alpha equals 0. That has a big peak at 0, not like with mu. So this is at least, at 0, this is a constant times x. That is bounded by x to 1/3. This part. So the approximation cannot be better than x to 2/3. X to 1 divided by x to 1/3. So the approximation cannot be better than x to 2/3. So if you actually get the best approximation, 2/3, and plug it here, we just get back to x1/6, which is already known, or better to say, which was known later. So even here, the improvement is not really possible with this idea. But on the other hand, I want to emphasize that in both of these approximations, we used very little about the Möbius function, almost nothing. In the first one, we only needed, the first one works equally well for any coefficient which is plus or minus one on square free numbers, but not the multiplicative property or anything, and zero otherwise. Here, even that is not necessary because we only need that, we need a big L2 norm, and it is zero on non-square free numbers, but anything on the rest. If the L2 norm is big enough, then we get a good lower bound. And it compared again to Littlewood conjecture and, well, it's not a conjecture theorem, it shows that very little is enough to improve the log to x power, because this one is very general in this sense. You only need that there are a bunch of zeros. And I am not going into details how to construct the function, but this is actually very simple, and I planned, but I, as usual, I speak much slower than I planned. But even the construction can be generalized. The only thing what is necessary that there are a bunch of zero among the coefficients, and they have some kind of structure. And then for that structure of zeros, you can build up an approximation. Okay, I believe that we can step back to the first approach, getting the weakest result. But this is the approach which is, on one hand, ready to more improvement and ready to generalizations for multiplicative functions, and this was my original idea, to generalize for general multiplicative functions from mu. You could see, as I pointed out, that in these two approaches we didn't use any multiplicativity. So the first approach is about the same year again, but this time with Perelli. Now this is the date when it appeared. It was done a few years back. And this uses a simple idea of Vaughan, who ten years earlier investigated the same question with the lambda n function. From Parseval, again, it is true that this is bounded from above by root x log x. The log x comes from the bigger maximal coefficients. And he proved that it is basically best possible. The proof is not that the result is not that surprising, because this function has peaks. We even know that the peaks are around rational numbers, a over q, and the size of the peak is about x over phi of q. And if it is big, then it is still big around, in a interval of length 1 over x. It must stay big, or about. So for a lower bound, we are allowed to select part of the integral, so select all rational numbers with up to a certain limit, and then only the integral around a over q, and the length is say 1 over 2x or 2 over x. I write it in this way. The thing. So x is small because of the length of the interval is so small, and we know, or at least we guess, that there is such a big peak of the function. So the integral itself is 1 over phi of q, at least, or about. X over phi of q is the size, and the length is 1 over x, so it is 1 over phi of q, but here we add for phi of q different residue classes, so that's a constant, so we get a lower bound, which is as many as we can do that. Well, if you really want to carry out this this project, then you cannot get too far with q, because you lose this knowledge as soon as q is bigger than, as soon as, say, q is about as big as a small power of x. However, a very neat trick, namely, in this position, you can use triangle inequality by putting the sum inside. That this is why I wanted to express in different ways. So write the a over q inside, in place of alpha write a over q minus eta, say, so the integral is independent of alpha, put the sum in, and then you can sum over a, and it works. It works because the peaks all show in the same direction. So you can just sum it up together, you can estimate what you got easily, and then you can add for any set of q, and of course there is a other limitation here, that q should be smaller or equal than root x, otherwise these intervals are not disjoint, and that root x is that root x. So we want to do the same with the Möbius function, but unfortunately the Möbius function has no peaks. Terry pointed out the result of Davenport today, that it is always small. Well, if it is always small, we know that that implies a certain big L1 norm, but it is unfortunately not that small that we are satisfied with the result. So what to do? I mention another result, that because we all feel that this is where the problem comes. If there are no Ziegler zeros, you can also ask that under the generalized Riemann hypothesis, but if there are no Ziegler zeros, then m of alpha is already known to be smaller than x divided by e to the a constant square root of log x. So the one possibility is simply, suppose there are no Ziegler zeros, then we get a lower bound e to the constant root log x. Suppose there is a Ziegler zero somehow relative to the problem, so somehow relative to x. And then using that Ziegler zero, one can point out some peaks, and one can collect the contribution of those peaks, and it's a miracle, but that works although more complicated, but works exactly the same way, and one can get that if there is a trigger zero, then collecting all the peaks generated by this zero, those peaks are not very big as the as Davenport upper bound shows, but still peaks, and one can actually come home with x to 1/2 minus epsilon, say. But this is the Ziegler zero case. If there are no Ziegler zeros, there is a much better way to use that information than just this one. Namely, one can point prove that in case of there are no Ziegler zeros, the well, that means that okay, we have to define major arcs and minor arcs like in circle method, and of course what major arc and minor arc is somehow defined of course for with x, so there will be a parameter r smaller than, to be on the safe side, even smaller than root x, but eventually we have to choose smaller. And then major arcs are the arcs around rational numbers with denominator at most r, and minor arcs is the rest. And what one can show that if there are no Ziegler zeros, then the contribution of the major arcs for the L2 norm is negligible. If the major arcs are denoted by this, then the contribution is smaller than x divided by log x to any power. But to prove that, it gives some limitation on r, and this is one headache for us because it is just missed. That time it just missed the power of x. R should be smaller or equal than e to a constant log x over log log x. But coupled this with another principle also mentioned by Terry, the Vinogradov-Vaughan method, which actually implies a much better upper bound, usually for every alpha, on the minor arcs, together provides, well, on the minor arcs, I can write here that Vinogradov-Vaughan and so on method implies that on the minor arcs, the bound is something like x over square root of r. Square root of r now appears as the definition of the minor arc, so every denominator is bigger than r, and maybe a bunch of log. And then the last step is to compare only the L, not the full L2 norm, but the L2 norm on the minor arcs, which is the major part, because that part is small, with this upper bound on the minor arcs. So the final result is something like square root of r as a lower bound, so a constant e to a constant times log x over log log x. This was the very first result, and it goes back 10 years now. And there is one thing I want to mention now as a conclusion. So there are three things I should like to see improved. One, the statement itself. So a better lower bound than x to 1/6, which is the best now. The second, a general theorem which works for all multiplicative functions with, say, absolute value at most 1, and then provide some, that of course we need some classification. It will not true for everyone. The constant one function, the Dirichlet kernel just gives log x. But, so a classification that what multiplicative function provides a big L1 norm. This is the second one. I didn't think about it yesterday evening, but by now there is even possibility generalization for nil sequences and so on. We just learned something this morning. So there are, I believe there are plenty of ways to start from this business and get some new and exciting results. Thank you very much.